From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Most of the U.S. media has been preoccupied trying to parse the various utterings by Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump, all the while obfuscating the substance of the massive leaks of data showing wrongdoing by Democratic presidential candidate Hillary Clinton and the DNC, with Cold War accusations of Russian spying and interference in the U.S. election. We instead bring you this first of a two-part newscast featuring a wide-ranging discussion with internationally recognized historian and author, activist and lawyer Dr. Gerald Horn of the national and international context in which the U.S. election is taking place, featuring analysis from a policy perspective of the candidates' positions on the important issues facing the world today. Dr. Horn's most recent book is Paul Robeson, The Artist as Revolutionary.
The United States faces a real crisis moment right now because, on the one hand, there is this international situation where China is advancing, where Russia has not been brought to heel, and where there's a lot of loose talk in Washington as a result about war, believe it or not, with China and or Russia sooner rather than later. However, one of the complicating factors is that the hawks and the neocons, who historically have attached themselves to the Republican Party, have expressed some discontent with the Republican nominee, Donald J. Trump. And so, therefore, many of them are defecting to the column of Hillary Rodham Clinton. This, in some ways, reminds me of the U.S. presidential election of 1964, when the Democrats under Lyndon Baines Johnson were successful, understandably perhaps, in painting the Republican nominee, Barry Goldwater, the conservative senator from Indiana, as being erratic, as the kind of man you would not want to have his finger on the nuclear button, as a person who was hostile to equality and human rights and civil rights. And that led directly to a landslide for Lyndon Johnson, who then, of course, as we all know, then escalated the war in Vietnam, began raining down bombs on Vietnam, and therefore set the stage for a Republican comeback in 1968 with discredited Richard M. Nixon. In some ways, we know that history does not repeat itself, but it does rhyme, as is often said. And if you look at the polls right now, with Hillary Rodham Clinton surging ahead, there is a possibility that once again, the Democrats will attain a landslide victory in November, but then that'll just set the stage for military conflict in 2017. We already know that Hillary Rodham Clinton was an engineer of the failed invasion and bombing of Libya that overthrew Muammar Gaddafi. We know that she is to the right of the Obama administration on intervention in Syria. And therefore, we should be quite concerned. Now, fortunately, there are alternatives in this election. That is to say that I was very struck in looking at the Huffington Post this morning to note that Jill Stein of the Green Party amongst black voters is ahead of Donald J. Trump. She's also ahead of Gary Johnson, the Libertarian. Mm. That is to say that according to the Huffington Post, Hillary Rodham Clinton is getting 83% amongst black voters. Jill Stein is getting 8%, and Gary Johnson and Trump come after that. Now, this is just after the nomination a few days ago. So I think that if we can build not only on that campaign, but other left-wing campaigns, we will be sending a message to the U.S. ruling elite that they will have difficulty in ignoring. That is to say that there are millions and millions of voters who are not in favor of continual and continuous war. And we should also recognize that the presidential election provides a wonderful opportunity for expressing this message. Al Gore can tell you that you can get the most votes in a presidential election and still lose. A U.S. presidential election, because of the archaic, antiquated electoral college, is actually 51 different elections. That is to say, 50 states and the District of Columbia. And we already know in advance who is going to prevail in 40 of those states. That is to say, we know, and history tells us, that it will be immensely difficult, to put it mildly, for the Democrats to prevail in Mississippi and Louisiana and Alabama and a good deal of Dixie. We also know that it would be insane to keep doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different result. That's to say, still continually running up these Democrats against Republicans in Dixie and expecting a different result, even though history over the decades has told us otherwise. So why not run left-wing candidates, anti-war candidates, progressive candidates, pro-reparations candidates in these particular states and pile up tens of thousands, perhaps millions of votes? It seems to me that this is a no-brainer.
Yeah. It's interesting that that hasn't been attempted on any large scale yet. I want to go to the landscape for this election. You have perhaps three manifestations, at least that's how it appears to me, of working class uprising, essentially, behind Sanders up to the point of the convention, and having met a lot of those folks at the convention, many of them plan to continue in that state. The workers, I would say almost exclusively, but primarily white workers behind Trump, and which is a good part of the constituency. We met them in Cleveland as well. And then, of course, the people that have been in the streets, Black Lives Movement and such. And the expression of, for example, that part of the working class that was behind Sanders was, essentially betrayed. Certainly, that's the feeling that the majority of them demonstrated at the convention. The approach to the people in the streets has been sort of multivaried. Attempts to co-opt on the one hand and, insert leadership that would proceed to the Democratic Party. Also, with the shooting of police officers, attempts to demonize the, entire movement. And then, of course, there is the entire elite lining up from the media and everyone else against Trump, who, meanwhile, in terms of those foreign policy items that are important, including the possibility of World War III, he's actually staked out a different, in some ways, oppositional position, to the extent you can take the word of any American politician, and particularly one with a background in real estate sales. So what is it exactly that can be done in that environment, and of course looking past the election, in terms of particularly what seems to me important, building some unity in the working class?
Well, first of all, with regard to Trump and foreign policy, I must take off my hat to The Nation, the weekly published in Manhattan, which has been second to none in its opposition to Trump, but at the same time reprimanded the Democrats and certain Democratic-leaning columnists like Paul Krugman of the New York Times when they have tried to paint Trump as some sort of proxy or agent for Vladimir Putin. It's a total capitulation and surrender to the worst Cold War biases. In fact, we even see that at the Olympics, where you have these gold medal swimmers from the United States who are engaging in Cold War behavior with their Russian competitors. This is all part of what appears to be an insane march towards a conflict with a leading nuclear power. It really is something that we should all be concerned about. Now, with regard to a class analysis of these elections, I think it's very important to get the history straight. And that's one of the downfalls and one of the weaknesses of the U.S. left, which tends to romanticize and glamorize the uglier aspects of U.S. history The United States has a very good hustle going, as they say in the streets. When there's something negative attached to U.S. history, and of course a good deal of it's negative, expropriation of Native Americans, enslavement of Africans, that's said to be not in tune with our founding values. That's not who we are, as Obama often says. And anything that's positive, that's who we are. I mean, what a hustle. I mean, and sadly, many of the left go along with this. What we need to tell those white working class supporters of Donald Trump is this, that you have a justifiable beef, but the beef is with the billionaire class, as Bernie Sanders might say. What I mean is that if you look at U.S. history, there was a kind of American dream for some, even though the late comedian George Carlin is correct when he suggested that it's an American dream because you have to be asleep in order to believe it.
Right.
But that's not altogether accurate because there are numerous cases of poor, straggling Europeans crossing the Atlantic, and because of expropriation of land from Native Americans, they can get land and they can get it stocked with Africans, and they can become wealthy. And that wealth is then passed on down the line to their children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren. But the working class needs to be told that those days are over and that the ruling class, in many ways, is moving and has moved to change the rules of the game for them. That kind of spectacular upward mobility is going to be very difficult going forward, and that the only way out is not continued alliances with billionaires, but alliances with their class brothers and sisters. Because the rules of the game have changed. We need to know that the rules of the game have changed, not least because of international pressure. That's to say that the Haitian revolutionaries and their comrades within the British abolitionist movement helped to create a general crisis for the slave system that led to that system's collapse, which thereby helped to free the enslaved Africans in North America, and that in the 20th century, the rise of a socialist camp and allied national liberation movements in the Caribbean and Africa helped to convince the U.S. ruling elite that if they wanted to compete with the socialist camp, they had to remove the more egregious aspects of white supremacy that were visited in the first place upon people of African descent. And that led to a change in the rules of the game. And that has led to the present situation that we are now facing. Therefore, the way out is not perpetual and constant conflict abroad with Russia and China in the first place, but with concord with those who are in conflict with the U.S. ruling elite, and concord with those who are in our class category here at home. That's a very simple lesson, but apparently it's a very difficult lesson to absorb. And I think it's more important than ever to absorb this lesson, because if you look at that stunning and staggering report that the Department of Justice put out on the Baltimore Police Department, it reeked of the worst excesses of apartheid South Africa. If you did not live in the United States, you might find it difficult to believe that a reign of terror was inflicted upon the black American population. But I think that hopefully a response has been within that black American community to break with the politics of the past, to begin to look towards political alternatives, to begin to protest more clamorously, particularly as expressed in the Black Lives Matter movement, and it would serve well the interests of the Euro-American working class to link up with that kind of movement, because that old pattern of thinking that the way out is alliance with the U.S. ruling elite against, say, Native Americans, as it happened in the 19th century, that path has been blocked, not to mention that it's unethical and immoral, and therefore a new path has to be blazed.
You know, I witnessed some things that were, I don't know, they're very interesting to observe, and frankly, left me agape here and there. just in terms of the like realignment that's taken place in such a short, at least in apparently such a short period of time. At the Republican convention, for example, and I was very close. I was a stage right against the wall, like 9 people from the front of the stage, and could see pretty much the entire arena react, which is what I was paying attention to. And when Trump said that the regime change and nation-building project was over, I saw the assembled Republican Party stand up and applaud wildly. And this is at a Republican convention, not let's go blow this up or that. He did some things with ISIS and this and that, and he got a response. But the biggest response I saw was that. It's like this deeply held feeling that even reaches there. And then at the Democratic convention, when Leon Panetta was speaking, and this happened also with Madeleine Albright to a smaller degree, but when Panetta was speaking and the Sanders delegates, or in any event, the large anti-war constituency of the assembly got up and started chanting "No more war," they were shouted down by people who apparently were instructed by the Clinton campaign to use this as a response, USA, USA, and showing like a break, you know, inside the Democratic Party over that issue, and unanimity among the Republicans against war. Bizarre for me.
Well, I think that's what's happening right now with not only the defections of many hawks and neocons to the Clinton column, but many corporate elites as well. There are many dangers involved in this process. One of the dangers is that two of the major constituencies of the Democratic Party, I'm speaking of the AFL-CIO unions, Service Employees International Union, American Federation of Teachers, American Federation of State, County, Municipal Employees, etc., they're really not up to speed on foreign policy. And the same holds true, I'm afraid, for what former NAACP Chairman Margaret Bush Wilson called the big minority. I'm speaking of Black Americans. That, of course, we know has a lot to do with the previous epoch. That is to say, the Cold War epoch, when radical leftists and labor were routed. I'm speaking of Harry Bridges of the International Longshore and Warehousemen's Union in San Francisco, and, of course, Paul Robeson in terms of the Black Liberation Movement. And this has meant that in the contemporary epoch, those two major constituencies are really not up to speed and are crippled when it comes to grappling with the more profound aspects of foreign policy. And this inevitably puts wind in the sails of the hawks and the neocons, who are able to leverage their advantage there in terms of the national budget, helping to shovel more money to the Pentagon and for war fighting, because our constituencies, such as labor and the national minorities, are not able to articulate a consistent anti-war and peace message. So this is a very dangerous situation that we're faced with. It's difficult to say how this is going to play out. I mean, for example, once again, this excoriating of Donald J. Trump, because he has said, he's basically taking a position on Moscow that represents the pre-2014 Obama position.
Right.
Recall that Obama's position was to have a reset with Russia so that there could be a pivot towards China. But what intervened was the Russian intervention in the Crimea, which has complicated relations with Russia and has led to this present downturn. And so when Trump tries to work out some sort of entente with Putin, he's really only expressing the pre-2014 Obama position. But you would not know that from reading the press. In fact, I think that students of journalism will have a field day in coming years and decades in analyzing the press coverage of this campaign. In some ways, it reminds me of how the U.S. press dealt with Howard Dean, the former Vermont governor who made a challenge for the White House some years ago after his infamous scream.
Yeah, one scream, I mean, and he's gone. One scream and he was gone.
Yeah, it was ridiculous. I mean, it was such a trivial issue that they turned into something that was character defining, that was paradigm shifting. and they ran him off the stage.
And that stage he entered, by the way, on this record campaign of small donations assembled over the internet. That was the significant thing, and that was dismissed by the elites and the media with a scream.
It was incredible. And I think that the way things are going now, that the United States is going to have a rocky road ahead, because if the election were held tomorrow, it would appear that Hillary Rodham Clinton would prevail. But you're going to have a lot of disgruntled Donald J. Trump supporters who are not going away anytime soon. At the same time, I think that Terry McAuliffe, the governor of Virginia and a close comrade of Hillary Rodham Clinton, probably hit the nail on the head when he suggested that after and if Clinton was elected, she would move to ratify the Trans-Pacific Partnership, TPP. This, of course, is a third rail for many in the Sanders movement and for quite a few in the Trump movement, because I think that the working class generally recognizes that the question of trade is really only a proxy for another issue, that other issue being how the U.S. ruling elite moves factories and work to low-wage havens and then drives down working conditions and wages here in the United States of America. Sadly enough, the New York Times in that editorial a few days ago on the question of trade totally missed that fundamental point. And if Hillary Rodham Clinton is elected, which now seems likely, there's going to be a battle royal with regard to this question of trade, which of course bleeds into the question of foreign policy generally. And hopefully we can help to educate the white working class supporters of Trump to realize that their fate and destiny does not lie in a backward-looking alliance with billionaires, but lies, in fact, with class solidarity with their brothers and sisters here in North America. Now, I know, as of now, that sounds overly romantic, but quite frankly, if we are to save this planet, that's the only way out.
Yeah, I agree with you. I don't know if it's romantic. It certainly looks formidable, but having met a lot of those folks, not as formidable as people may believe from following the media, because they were not as advertised, a group of maniacs with swastikas and stars and bars and all that. They were actually, a lot of them, working class people. So on the question of what McAuliffe said, you know, there's also the parallel, although the Obama administration's public stance on Russia was what it was up to 2014. The operation that took down the elected government in Kiev was conducted by, you know, both U.S. intelligence and the U.S. State Department. You had Pyatt and Nuland on the phone call. You could see what was being engineered there. Those really are Clinton's people, particularly Nuland, who goes back to Bill Clinton's administration. Does that mean, well, it seems to me that it means that similar to the predicted shift on a position on TPP back to the original, that we might be looking at a more aggressive and openly aggressive stand towards Russia with Clinton. What do you think of that?
Well, this is something that's in the works, I'm afraid. Today's Washington Post carries a story about how Clinton is treading a very careful line. On the one hand, she wants to win over these hawks and neocons, the few who have not defected to her column already. But at the same time, she's worried about riling up the Sandersistas, that is to say the peace forces within the Democratic Party. What that suggests to me is that if the result of the election is a landslide for Clinton, with left-wing parties not doing very well, you can take it to the bank that there's going to be a major military conflict in 2017. Most likely, there will be two flashpoints. One will be Syria, and the other will be Ukraine. I dare say that a Clinton-Kane administration will see as a major priority rolling back the Russian intervention in Crimea. Also, I dare say that a Clinton-Cain administration will seek to depose forever the al-Assad regime in Damascus in league with their allies in Saudi Arabia and Qatar. Now, of course, a fly in the ointment are the events of July 15th, 2016 in Turkey with the failed coup and the concomitant escalation of anti-U.S. imperialist sentiment in Turkey, because Ankara has reason to believe that U.S. imperialism was, if not complicit, at least cheerleading on the coup makers, which has led to President Erdogan making his first trip abroad since July 15th to Moscow, leading to a relaxation of tensions with Moscow and Russia. The only problem there is that President Erdogan still continues to push this idea that a national priority for Ankara should be liquidating Kurdish resistance. And this is something that Moscow is not wholly on board with. In fact, this is something that a good deal of humanity is not on board with. And that makes Erdogan vulnerable because, of course, U.S. imperialism and Saudi reactionary clerics and leaders are not adverse to liquidating the Kurds or any other force that gets in the way of their messianic plots and plans. So this makes for a very dangerous recipe for 2017 as we contemplate the possibility of a Clinton administration surging to power without a vote in the millions for left-wing parties in the United States.
You know, also, I'd like to look at that geopolitically, too, because Turkey making nice with Russia holds out the possibility, although it was said yesterday that this is not in the cards, of a realignment of Turkey's foreign policy away from NATO and towards Russia. Geopolitically, militarily, that's a very significant possibility if it comes to fruition. In other words, the placement or the use of Turkish airspace, for example, by the Russian Air Force based in Syria and or elsewhere adds a tremendous amount of movement to Russian defense against the NATO attack. Also, negating Turkey as a base for launching an attack would have significant consequences as well. So what do you think are the prospects for some kind of significant geopolitical shift that may be in the making now? And what do you think would be the consequences of that for the plans that seem to be to at least squeeze Russia?
Well, that is a very distinct possibility. That is to say, a Turkish realignment with Russia, which would obviously be a blow to the North Atlantic Treaty Organization led by the United States of America. I might also say that if you look at this in the European context, it's even more intriguing. What I mean is that the Brexit, the impending British withdrawal from the European Union, is also shaking up Europe, because there are preliminary indications that British foreign policy will seek to reorient itself not only away from Europe, but perhaps as a spearhead against Europe. The only question is whether that spearhead against Europe will be in league with Washington, in which case that will inevitably cause what can only be described as a nightmare in Washington, which is that pushing Germany towards Russia. Recall that part of the import and impact of February 2014 and the Russian intervention in Crimea was allowing Washington the opportunity to pressure Germany to move away from a multi-billion-dollar relationship with Russia.
And we'll have part two of this wide-ranging discussion with Dr. Gerald Horn about the international and national context of the U.S. election in our next newscast. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar.